Productions. Recorded live.
And welcome to the Q&A session for October the 19th, 2009. So we will begin with our questions today. And that's not where they're located. There we go. Oops. I erased the questions. One moment, please. I may have just killed the call with that move. Okay, sorry for the silence here while I get my act together again. There we go. There, we're back. Got it. Okay. So just for fun, I'm going to go backwards today instead of frontwards. Just so we can change up the flow. So the first question on the list today. Is working through pain. How will I know if I'm working through the pain versus stuffing it, suppressing it? For example, when I get intrusive thoughts, I do what I can to get to stop thinking about them. Is that suppression? Is it crying when I need to cry and talking about it when I need to talk about it? Is that how I know I'm working through the pain? Yeah, I think that obviously there are times that the intrusive thoughts have nothing to do with working through the pain. The intrusive thoughts certainly can trigger the pain. Sometimes I feel like with the intrusive thoughts, due to the kind of the trauma nature of those things, that being able to stop obsessing on some of those intrusive thoughts is very important. At the same time, it's not the same thing, I think, and I don't want you to avoid the pain. So I think when it's time to talk about it, you talk about it, you allow yourself to cry about it, you don't try to avoid it. I think a lot of times people just flat out never want to say that anything happened, and that to me is very much avoiding the pain or pretending that the pain's not there. So to me, there's kind of a weird angst in terms of stuffing and intrusive thoughts. There are probably some really healthy ways of – turn this off – some healthy ways of dealing with the pain, like just processing through it. I still know that the intrusive thoughts are the ones that always trigger those pieces. So having groups where you can talk about it, I think, is important. Being able to journal about it, giving yourself time to talk about it or to read about it, to study about it, those to me are healthy ways of dealing with it. Just reacting to intrusive thoughts is not. So hopefully you can still limit the number of intrusive thoughts, and I hope that happens for you. Why do so many – second question here. We've got a lot of questions, so I'm going to move here pretty quick till I'm sure that we are going to have time to cover everything. Why do so many unfaithful spouses say, I don't remember when asked about the infidelity? Do they really not remember, don't want to remember, or a bit of both? Frequently, I mean, I think – you know, it's hard. You have to know a person's heart. A lot of times they don't remember because I believe that people tend to suppress those things and they're trying not to think about them. I do believe, though, that it behooves them to be willing to say, I don't remember, but let me take time to try to figure that out. If you're currently taking the 911 course, you'll find toward the end of the course, I talk a little bit about the way the differences between the way men and women store information. And it really is true that somebody, a guy, may have compartmentalized something and kind of taken it off the hard drive, as I would say. And so they have to be really intentional to try to go back and remember it. They have to sit down, slow down, and think about it and to get back to that place. So, you know, if someone's giving a quick answer, I don't remember, I would just say, then would you at least find some time to think about it and try to remember, because there's a good chance they might be able to if they really worked on it. Here's another one. See, I don't feel content with my situation at all. Let's just go back. Recently, on the forums, an unfaithful spouse had been posting about not being able to give up his affair partner. I feel I'm addicted to my affair partner. It's like I'm unable to stop. I have such a good time with her. I feel so safe, and I can be myself with no reservations. Yet, I know I'm completely doing this wrong. Could you please address this for him? Limerence and having someone that's what I would call almost addicted to a person is a very difficult circumstance. I end up seeing this all the time, and so it's pretty common. And literally, there is a drug reaction that's occurring when they're with that person. It's almost like being addicted to heroin, because it does. It makes you feel incredible. In fact, I was talking to somebody just before the call today, a woman who's in the same sort of situation, and she said, you know, I really want to be in my marriage, and yet I can't stop thinking about my affair partner. It's all I think about. And then when I see my mate upset, it makes it even more difficult, simply because I just remember how wonderful it was when I was with my affair partner. And then the other problem, you know, is she was reporting, is I don't know how I can ever have feelings for my mate again. And I think that's when the feelings are so intense in that limerence situation for the other person. It's very discouraging, partially because you will have lost a lot of your desire for your mate, or what desire you have for your mate will really be kind of seem very pale compared to the intensity of the emotions attached to the affair partner. Three things typically have to happen before somebody gets out of that situation. First, you've got to be willing to give up the affair partner at the very least for a season. You know, what I recommend is you start with a 90-day commitment of no contact, and at the same time, I recommend that you get on like a serotonin reuptake inhibitor to help with some of the obsessive thinking, if you've got a doctor who will work with you on the depression that ensues. Because if you're doing well emotionally, it makes it much, much easier to kind of fight that battle. But if you're really depressed and over the entire situation and the craziness of your life, the desire to drug seek, to go back and use that person as a way of mood altering and avoiding a difficult situation, that temptation is really strong. So if we can at least avoid that temptation by getting you on some type of antidepressant, that's really helpful. And the SSRIs, the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, also help with obsessive thoughts. So it allows you to think, it gives you far more choice in what you want to think about rather than just being compelled to think about something you don't want to think about. And so that's one of the huge advantages of getting on some sort of antidepressant. If you can go the 90 days with no contact, and that's a great start. And usually by the end of that time, there's enough sanity that occurs that you can begin to look at the situation rationally. And from that rational perspective, well, it allows you to see where you're going. Now, desire for your mate. Two things have to occur before the desire for your mate will occur. One, you've got to process through the stuff with the affair partner where you in your own mind have determined that that's really not a good choice for you. And the majority of the time, I've got a little ebook that I'm not sure if it's posted on the website or not right now called 31 Reasons to Stop an Affair. But it's helpful in the sense that it kind of gives some ideas of, I think, kind of motivations to not go back to the affair and maybe some of the insanity. So if you get your mind around why the affair is not good, then, and you're disconnected from that, then you can begin working on the marriage. On the marriage piece, several things have to happen. Typically, the person in that sort of relationship will, at the very least, have really taken a negative view on the marriage because everything was so incredible in the affair, and will typically have a lot of resentments toward the marriage. So you have to begin with being able to forgive your affair partner and working through those resentments, releasing those resentments. And after you've been able to release those resentments, the second thing that you've got to be able to do is look for a lot of the positive characteristics. You want to be able to see your mate very differently. And some of that's not that you're making up things about your mate, but it really is shifting what you look for in your mate. Normally, after someone forgives their mate, where they've really been able to let go of those resentments, it is about, I find, 6 to 9 months before the feelings and the desires begin to come back for your mate, but they do return. Because you know, if you think about it logically, if you had those feelings once upon a time and you were able to lose those feelings, you kind of cared about them and you didn't care about them, well, just the fact that it can change one way also is an indication that it can change back the other way. I mean, it's a kind of a dynamic process. It has the ability to move back and forth, to wax and wane. One of the things that's a barrier with the affair partner, and this is why it's so hard initially to give it up and why it's a little confusing, and we've talked about this before, but the affair is still based on romanticism. And romanticism, the motivational template, what's pushing you in an affair is ultimately you want what you don't have, and you long to get what you think will ultimately make you happy. In the marriage at this point, you have what you don't want. And so you can just see from those two different mindsets which one's going to be the more appealing. But if you step back and you disconnect from that affair partner and you begin to see your mate, you can begin to have dreams again and visions and appreciate them. And you can find that you want something with that person too. It comes from a different place within you. And it is more than doable. A little farther, another post here.
Rick?
Yes.
This is Wendy.
Yeah, Wendy.
I sent you a little chat message there.
I'm on September 28th?
Yes.
Holy smoke. I'm on the totally wrong week. This is
embarrassing. Well, they were questions I had sent in before, so I recognized them.
I'll be darned. Look at that. That's the first mistake I've made all year. Let's see here. Sorry about that. This is a good question,
answers,
though.
Great answers, though.
Okay. Load up here. Sorry, everybody. There. Now I'm on. I wonder how I did that. Now I'm on the right week. Ah. Amazing. Okay. Let's see. Could you list some of the questions for am I a sex addict? I understand that will not necessarily be definitive, but could you give some examples, please? Someone who's the typical answers, and maybe I should post a link that would really help with this.
Yeah, it's for some women in the Harboring Hope group that were
right. There, Mark Laser has a great link on just a good test. I think it's probably one of the best ones. And it's actually something he's done in conjunction with Patrick Carnes. So I think it's actually on Patrick Carnes' website. And if somebody's on a computer, if they could just go to Patrick Carnes' website and see if you can find that assessment tool, because that's the first thing I start with. I really like his assessment tool.
Okay.
And if you get that, if you'll post that in the chat, I'll read it out loud here.
Sure.
But with the sex addict, I mean, ultimately, sex becomes a way of living life. It's what it affords them is the opportunity to not have to live with life in some ways. They can escape because it makes them feel better. So it just becomes an avoidant technique. It's something that eventually kind of, I like to say, you know, at first we eat to live and then we live to eat. At a certain point, it becomes so important to us that the thought of not having it, not being able to do it, kind of seems a little bit inconceivable to us, in the sense that we almost have to have that behavior or that activity, whatever that negative activity is, just to feel normal. Because if we don't have that activity, we don't feel normal anymore. I think that's a huge one in terms of the way I look at it. Another thing with the sex addict, which just escaped my mind, so that wasn't good. It may come back in a second. You know, there's the whole thing that you end up probably doing more than you intend. That's a huge piece. It controls you rather than you controlling it. There's a chemical dependency with it, or literally sexual addiction isn't a behavioral addiction, it's a chemical addiction. And it really is an addiction more to the endorphins and that particular feeling that are being created as a result of that activity. It's progressive in nature. You tend to do more and more over time, or need more and more over time. The website is Patrick Carnes, Carnes, sexhelp.com.
Just sexhelp.com is the thing.
Oh, just sexhelp.com.
Yeah.
Okay, excuse me.
I'm
sexhelp.com. And he'll have a survey on there that's a very good survey. And so I use that for a lot of my people. Sexual addiction, let's see. Do you recommend support groups for spouses of sex addicts? Absolutely. And I recommend, you know, just maintaining sanity and getting out of the insanity, I think, is really important, just like with Al-Anon. Now, a lot of times, if there's not a COSA group available, which would be a group for spouses married to sex addicts, I recommend Al-Anon. I have a lot of people use Al-Anon just because there's not a COSA group available for them. There's also an online COSA group, and then, sorry, I don't have that, again, at the tip of my fingers here.
I think I can find it. Hang on.
And the online COSA group is another place. For COSA, just like with Al-Anon, you know, really it's beginning to accept that I am powerless over my mate and what they do. And, you know, my life is unmanageable. That I am not capable of controlling this thing with them. And it's really learning to focus on something very, very different. Now, what you choose or don't choose to do with your mate, that's another issue. But in terms of how you live in order to stay sane, that's going to be really important. Now, here's a long question. Love long questions. I know, Rick. I know you hate to read these out loud. So I'll start with the question, then you can leave out the elaboration. Question. Anger is a powerful issue on both sides of betrayal. Amen. And it becomes an unfortunate weapon in the fight against healing and reconciliation. Yes, anger is a huge barrier. If the betrayed spouse can no longer control their anger, then they become aggressors while the unfaithful spouse becomes the victim, perhaps the strangest paradox of recovery. if the anger continuum has perhaps has a base, behavior modification, an apex, spiritual reality, faith, controlled by the will and the strength of the victim, then how does the victim manage the middle ground of cognitive distortion, especially difficult since the aggressor is in denial of the distortions they're using to escalate and perpetuate their anger? Do they confront, reject, soothe it like a base behavior, or do they wait patiently, like David and Shimei, for God to take over? I'm going to keep reading a little bit farther here. It would seem that distortions can only be defeated from within by the will of the aggressor slash offender. As a matter of acceptance and resignation toward the ending of one's anger and emotions that lie beneath it. This takes incredible bravery and patience in the face of a smart, anger, dedicated, addicted partner. How does one avoid mismanagement at this crucial juncture? Elaboration. It seems that the anger management strategies work at three different levels. First, our behavioral distortions are all childish elementaries, school playground tactics for anger acceleration, so all you have to do is see them that way and control mandate slash rule them into unusability. When I try one of these on my spouses, I'm acting like a heckled second grader and should be scolded, then counseled, then soothed and self-soothed about them. My spouse is my solution by rejecting my behavior as culturally acceptable, not personally objectionable. The cognitive distortions are more at the high school, junior college level, though they can be intricately woven by a smarter Ivy Leaguer to the cum laude level. These distortions become so self-feeding and automatic as to become addictive. Thus, the judgmental cynic with the jaundiced eye and the label gun of black and white personalization, how many did I get? If my spouse has become such a sitting cobra of pain, it is much more complex and difficult. It is a much more complex and difficult solution for me to find for them, since they must live in the world of rejection and denial and pride and shame to support these cognitive distortions. If they don't choose to overcome these distortions, then they become the perpetual grad student and the poser addicted to the anger anabolic steroid of escalation, on and on. The last level is the spiritual reality, and that is the two graduate when they've realized that they don't know what's good or bad, only God does. So, basically, in explanation here, what he's saying is that when a couple, when you begin recovery as a couple, that a lot of times the betrayed spouse loses it to the point where they actually become the aggressor, creating pain for the unfaithful spouse. And the unfaithful spouse at that point, at one level, is really being traumatized and victimized now by the betrayed spouse. So, you know, what do you do with that? Because they're making the point that it's difficult to get the person with anger to address the issue. I guess, in my mind, if you can come to an agreement within a relationship about what are appropriate boundaries, I mean, I almost take that one from a boundary perspective, and where you set out that this is about love, and any time we begin to treat our mate in a way that's contrary to love, that's not where we want to be. That's not the direction we want to go. And so each of you needs to have standards of respect and honor, even though the anger is there. Remember, the anger is not the problem when you're dealing with marriage. The anger is a secondary emotion People are angry. It's the expression of the anger, you know, whether it be passive aggressive or aggressive. If you confront your mate, and whether betrayed or unfaithful, and they're unwilling to, or they don't agree with you or don't see the issue with the anger, at that point, I think you actually need to pull a third party in and get somebody else to help you kind of address the issue with your mate and see if y'all can, again, get to a common ground. It is very difficult. In the video, part of what he's talking about here is that we talk about managing anger from three different perspectives. One, from a behavioral perspective. Two, from a cognitive behavioral perspective, where you change your thought pattern. And three, from a spiritual perspective. And he was just saying that the behavioral is kind of elementary. The cognitive distortion takes a little bit more, it's a little headier, and it is, he's at high school, and then he was saying that the spiritual is heart, and that that's kind of the highest level of managing anger. I don't disagree with that. I just know that if you set the boundary and the other person's violating the boundary at some point, you're going to have to address it, and you're going to have to, again, get a third party in, because it's difficult where you've got a really emotionally charged relationship for the other person to hear feedback from you. I think you can tell them that they are hurting you. But if they don't listen, I think it's terribly important to try and find somebody to help mediate and get that taken care of. So that was a long question. Now, on the COSA, COSA-recovery.org. is where you can get more information about COSA if you are looking for help with as a co-addict. And Harboring Hope, I mean, things like that are also things you can do that help with this sort of situation. And it provides its own sort of support group, almost a 12-step-like group. It's a little different because, remember, 12-step is about learning how to live within a different system. Harboring Hope is more about what do you do with the pain and how do you grieve and begin to heal. Here's another one. Tomorrow is 4 months since. Sorry about that. Tomorrow is 4 months since my husband literally moved from our bedroom to his adulterous bedroom. We didn't know his whereabouts for 45 days when the adulterous husband called me. 4 weeks ago, I received the first contact ever via email from my husband while still living with the other woman, and all he wanted was his deer rifle and deer lease keys. Isn't it funny how God knew I still had something he wanted? I didn't realize I had the keys to the lease. I didn't respond. The second email 1 week later was the same request. I didn't respond. Now, 18 days later, deer season starts in November, so I'm assuming he is anxious. My husband now calls my cell this morning, right before 8 a.m., first time since he left, but did not leave a message. This was his habit to call on his way to work. It is when he used to call his adultery partner each morning after he left her home. Of course, it's still about the deer lease keys and the rifle. He wasn't brave enough to leave a message. And still pray daily for the chaos and strife in that relationship, and that God will bring him to the cross. Question: how would my complete silence and refusal to engage in this at all leave him feeling at this point? He is a sex addict, third affair, two other events, porn, sex calls, etc., and just wants what he wants when he wants it. 1 Corinthians 5:5, I'm just letting him walk with Satan. Where God is taking me and my children, I'm not sure, but I'm standing on his promise and waiting for direction. Through Al-Anon and counseling, I know that I cannot be engaging in this match with him, much like a tennis game. He lobs the ball at me, and I choose to ignore the serve. This is a healthy response. This need for his rifle and keys is the first consequence he's ever had to face all by himself for 24 years. I saved him, codependent, in the past, and he never had any consequences. If I had let him face his own consequences, he may have found sobriety before now. So how would my complete silence and refusal to engage in this leave him feeling at this point? Again, I can only speculate. Don't know how in the long run it might make him feel. I suspect there'll be a part of him that will be angry, and he will use that anger ultimately as a way of justification for why he's doing. And he had a – there's a great question down here. I'm going to get to that in a second, Margie. So at one level, because he's already probably using a whole bunch of justifications here, and in those justifications, it's just, this is just going to add one more thing as to why he made the right decision. That doesn't mean that it's a wrong decision not to respond with him at this level. I don't know, ultimately, which way you need to go. I think that you're probably right. Responding to him at this point potentially sets off the whole volley again. And I don't know what you do. I think that waiting and seeing kind of how he responds to this, because just calling, in my opinion, and saying I want the keys and the deer rifle after 45 days of no contact and abandoning the kids, I'm not sure I would really even make a response to that call. I'm kind of with you. I wouldn't get back into that game with him and let him see kind of in time how he works that out. But also understand that you're not responding to him isn't an attempt. I wouldn't want it to be an attempt to try to change him. Just understand at this point, continuing to participate with him in that level of sanity is nuts. So I don't blame you for not responding, and I think I might do the same thing. Now, Margie asks, which is a good question here, she says, does that mean, on the previous question, the hurt spouse can never express outright anger complete with volumes and gestures? I was nice about it. So let me correct that. Absolutely not. There are times that I think what he's talking about is a very destructive pattern of anger that goes on and on. I think we all have incidences where we lose it. I think that it's the when you begin to use anger, however, as a way of punishing the other person and trying to extract vengeance in some way, rather than just a really great expression for how you're feeling at that particular moment. And if you do it continually, and it always, through those cognitive distortions of how you're looking at it, you lose perspective, and anger becomes kind of your primary way of relating to someone, then I think that's when, to me, anger becomes a problem. When it's always about hurting the other person, or you don't care that you're hurting the other person, there is, you know, that's a little bit sad. And I think that even if someone completely loses it, well, you know, if you still have a heart, you may still say, you know, I think I lost it there a little bit too much. You know, I mean, and I have a lot of people say to me, both hurt and unfaithful, that, you know, they really regret, they grieve at times over how they acted because it's not them. I mean, they just go to a place they've never even been before, and I understand that. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a compulsive pattern where, A, the other person just doesn't care and is trying to inflict pain all the time, not a losing it situation. And kind of the way they look at life is now just making them continually respond with anger. But one other thing I want to say about anger that's kind of interesting, if you think about a wheel, I was working on this last week with maybe three quadrants or three, that pie has three pieces there. One one, let's say one of those quadrants, or not quadrants, it's four, one of those pieces of pie has anger in it. One of them has hurt in it, and one of them has positive affection, connection, love in it. What happens for the hurt spouse a lot of times is they'll be in the hurt or they'll be in the pain, and when they can't handle the pain anymore, then they flip into anger as a way to anesthetize their pain and avoid the pain. Because when you take that pain and shoot it outward at someone else, it separates it off from you. So it's a great anesthesia. That's what anger ultimately does for you. But then let's say you do that and you rip them a new one and you just see them responding. Let's say they have a perfect response and they respond in love and they're just going, I deserve that. You know, and they continue just to open their heart to you. Well, then with that intimacy, what happens is that you'll find in your own heart a part of you really being drawn to them. So let's say now you move back into that affection and appreciation and you start moving toward them. Well, if you get too close to them, there's another part of you that wants to kill you for having gotten too close to them. So internally you end up with a civil war, and now you get really mad at them and push them away because you're mad at yourself for having gotten too close to them. Well, then you go back into hurt because now that just reminds you of all the pain. But then you go back into anger to anesthetize the pain, and then you go back into feeling and caring for them deeply, which then throws you back into pain or back into anger. So there's a wheel spinning, and actually moving too close to your mate, and let's say you shouldn't move close, that's not the point, but if you've ever been betrayed, when you kind of have really strong feelings and appreciation and respect and admiration for them, you're aware of that other part of you that comes in and tells you you're crazy and starts beating the snot out of you, which then just creates more pain or makes you really angry at them for making you like them, which is kind of crazy. But the whole thing is insane. So hopefully that gives you an idea of maybe what that cycle is a little bit that people are going through. Let's see. True test. Is there a true test as to whether a relationship is going to survive betrayal, a sex addiction or not? It would save a lot of pain and wasted effort, especially on the hurt spouse's part, if this were the case. I know you are in the business of trying to restore relationships, and you probably couldn't get anyone to listen to you if you hadn't experienced it yourself, but what was the common denominator in the relationships of the 10% who you say don't make it? Great question. And, there are two really big indicators. One, if a couple has had at least 10% of their relationship that went well, so they know a little bit of what it feels like and what it looks like, then it's much, there's at least Dave Carter's research shows there's about a 90% predictability of them being able to work it out. The second one, though, is really interesting. There are two factors that are important. And one of them, I don't quite know how to predict it. But for some people, sometimes for the hurt spouse, the trauma because of their past childhood and things like that is so great. It just takes them so long to move beyond it. And sometimes in those situations, they're unable to come back. More frequently, though, what causes that 10% is the person who's already kind of stepped out of the relationship via the affair, or maybe who is dealing with the sexual addiction, they're not willing to do whatever it takes in terms of their own recovery. And that ultimately without the environment of safety, if you can't set it up where it's safe, and if you can't come to a place where you can both agree on monogamy and what the rules of the relationship are going to be and the rules of engagement, ultimately then those relationships will fail. And somebody, you know, if you're the unfaithful spouse, the one who's kind of violated the boundary there, and understand, we all maybe violate boundaries. We all are hurtful in a relationship, but where you go outside it, you still have to create that safety or nothing will happen. Let's see. Now this one, this explains very much where I'm at with my husband. Which explains. So let's see here. Okay. Need your advice. Rick, we are several years out from discovery of my husband's affair with a much younger work assistant and was an emotional affair for a number of years before it became physical. He is still unwilling to admit there was anything going on until maybe shortly before the sexual part started. At that point, I discovered the sex. We ended up separating. Almost 2 years later, we decided to give it another try and have now been back together 3+ years. My husband tells me he is sorry for all the pain and hurt his affair caused, and I believe he really is. However, the big problem for me is that he's not willing to talk to anyone or to get help dealing with the affair recovery. He tells me that he's dealing with so much guilt and shame, and since he doesn't know how to pay back for all that hurt and pain he's caused me, that all he can do is just try to make sure my car is always clean and that he's doing most of the homework and stuff, so I don't have to worry about that, since I'm currently recovering from shoulder surgery. This is all wonderful, and I do appreciate all that he does for me. He's also treating me way better than he ever did in the past 26 years of our marriage. Unless I have a trigger and any of my anger or other emotions over all this happened to come out, I actually feel that I'm making him happy, and he loves me. Heck, he even likes me and tells me so. However, if anything I do or say makes him feel at all uncomfortable, then the tide instantly turns the other way. It seems I have not done a very good job of explaining why it is important that we get help and actually get this stuff out of the darkness and into the light of God's truth, where it can be looked at, processed, and worked through. I want a marriage that is healed, not one that exists in the land of pretend normal. I can survive like this for a little while, but I don't even want to think about spending the rest of my life this way. I believe I would die an ugly, slow, and very painful death from the inside out. At this point, I'm focusing on my own issues, codependency, etc. God's working in my heart and life in an amazing way. But I need to know how I should respond when he tells me that he is doing to pay back and be such a wonderful husband now. I have no desire to offend him or anything like that, but I do need him to understand that all the doing in the world doesn't take the place of working through what happened. Any thoughts? Boy, I don't know how you get him to do this, but he's one of those candidates for a 12-step program or individual therapy if he would do it, because maybe EMDR would work really well for someone like this, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. But when you've got somebody that has such intense shame and such intense guilt, what's happening is every time that gets hit, he's flooding. It's hitting a trauma wound for him, and he's really, really flooding. And it is true, his way. There are two primary ways of dealing with trauma wounds. One is what's called hypervigilance. And a whole lot of people, a lot of times the hurt spouse will become very hypervigilant. And it's always like you're trying to watch, trying to keep it from happening again. So you're always kind of in a constant state of total anxiety and kind of in a fight or flight all the time, just looking. That's where I'll say that, you know, someone may get a cornea transplant and they'll begin looking at the people of the opposite sex, if it's an opposite sex sort of attraction, all the time, because they're always trying to kind of guard, making sure that they don't get hurt again, making sure nothing happens again. But the other way of dealing with a trauma wound is through avoidance. And that person lives their life trying to avoid not getting triggered, because when they get triggered, the pain is so incredibly intense, it just totally floods and overwhelms them. And when you have somebody that lives in avoidance, I mean, that's really sad, because when you trigger that shame for him, and I'm not saying that you can live your life trying to live and pretend normal and trying not to trigger his trauma wound. I mean, he's got to take responsibility for that. Potentially, if you can get him to read a little bit on PTSD and reframe it, that might, post-traumatic stress disorder, excuse me, I'm talking in acronyms, that might be able to help a situation like that a little bit. Being able to have him read something, not about the affair, if he would, but something on shame. But being in with other people dealing with shame and finding that you're still loved and accepted, in my mind, is probably the most effective way, which is what programs like AA or Al-Anon or any of those types of 12-step programs really do a great job of helping detoxify, celebrate recovery is what I was trying to think of, work really hard at trying to help detoxify that shame. And if he won't do a group, then, you know, even if he would do individual therapy, and I hear you say that's really difficult for him, but I can just, what you're describing, though, is somebody who's kind of got a trauma wound and or that shame is really inhibiting their ability to address the situation. So I hope you'll get help, because that sort of thing typically doesn't get better with time. That problem in him has nothing to do with the affair. That problem has to do with a much deeper issue, a core issue for him. Because most people can look at it and process through it without flooding, and but he's handling it by going avoidant. And anytime I see somebody that's going totally avoidant, I just know that they flood and it's an issue with the trauma. Okay, next. I've rewritten my question several times, trying not to give you the whole horrible history, and apologize for this long preamble. It seems like you are better able to answer questions when there's sufficient background. Yeah, it's the truth. Thank you. Here's the best concise information explanation I can whittle it down to. My husband had an emotional affair that was not disclosed to have been physical on and off for 10 years. In those 10 years, there was ineffective counseling. Hard to be effective when my husband avoided, denied, lied, deceived. Discovery was a year and a half ago. Fast forward to now. We are both in separate but coordinated counseling. We live in the same house with our two children. My husband is a true prodigal son in the sense that he decided to turn away from his emotional and sexual affair, use of porn, financial irresponsibility, verbal and emotional manipulation, and abuse. He's taking responsibility and is finally learning how to be a Christian man, husband, father, business owner. And I'm trying really hard to be patient and encouraging in that process. He is being patient with the process of healing that I'm needing, grief, depression, regaining a sense of self and self-esteem and purpose, and trying to get beyond the current chaos caused by the chaos and upheaval from the past 10 years. I feel there still needs to be more disclosure, but I'm having difficulty determining what I may still want to know or need to know to help healing. I feel our separation of 9 months was not long enough, but the financial burden of separate homes would have put our house at risk. Custody during legal separation was emotionally too much for me to bear at that time. Having him back home has afforded us time to work on parenting, finances, and finally, the other issues that were there. In the meantime, I don't know how to define this relationship. I know we're still legally married, but I don't feel married. I feel our marriage was severed long ago when he refused to address the emotional affair and then willfully entered into a sexual affair. I detached about 6 years ago with the increasing verbal abuse and started working on becoming financially independent enough to leave. I'd given him my wedding ring back, and when he refused to return to counseling, and until he started working on the marriage seriously, I still don't even know if I want it back. We're living in the house together platonically. We are parenting our kids together. We sleep in the same bed. At times, I feel guilty and ashamed that we are becoming because our intimacy is not restored. I can't even say I can be affectionate with him, or anyone for that matter. I feel like I'm doing what God wants me to do, but at the same time, I feel like the marriage ended so long ago. We're living together, but I don't feel married. This is a big obstruction to me. It just doesn't feel right to me, and I don't know how to reframe it, if I need to at all. I reframed so much over the years that it worked against my emotional health. Like, I brainwashed myself into believing that things were going to be better if I worked hard enough to save the marriage. That wasn't even there to save. How can I really call this marriage? I don't even know how to define this relationship. What do I do with these feeling unmarried but still tied? So why don't you ask a really hard question? That one's not hard enough. Well, you know, I know, at least in my experience, a lot of people come to the place where they no longer feel married, which is why in Harboring Hope, the fourth stage that we talk about is the stage of recommitment. And until there is a decision ultimately to recommit to the relationship, in some ways you may still be legally married, but in your heart you're still separated and somewhat divorced. I call there's a thing I call emotional divorce, where in your head you're together because you think you're supposed to be, but in your heart you've already left your mate. And in that sort of situation, it's almost like you are starting anew, and hopefully with the work that he's doing, becoming a good man, those are the things over time, and I can't remember what the time thing, how long y'all have been really working on this thing, a year and a half ago. Y'all are not far enough down the line. And in this sort of situation, when I say 18 to 24 months, I don't know what happened a year and a half ago, but y'all are just, if you were separated for 9 months and all of that, you really haven't been even back under the same roof for 12 months yet. And hopefully over time, you know, that you will begin to feel safe enough. I mean, unconsciously, there's a part of you that's going to protect you from him, and rightfully so. The other piece, you know, hopefully he's made decent amends to help you toward this and taking responsibility. He's just going to have to give you time to try to come back. I would say you want one of the things that concerns me listening to what you're saying here is you cannot force your desire to come back for another person. Desire, there is a place of will in desire, so I'm not saying that it's not there, but to come from your heart, if you try to make yourself do something, eventually you'll just kind of get resentful. So even if you feel something for him, my recommendation is you starve it a little bit. It's kind of like when you're trying to build a fire and you've got a little bitty flame going, the last thing you want to do is dump a bunch of wood on it because it smothers the fire. What you want to do is kind of starve the fire a little bit as you give it wood and give it a chance to begin to grow. And that's how people's hearts begin to soften. Another thing, I don't want you to brainwash yourself in the least, saying that if you work hard, you can save the marriage. But I would say that shifting potentially what you look at in him and how you look at him is going to be very important in the long run, because, again, if you can't find things you appreciate about him and things to admire in him, things that you're grateful for about in him, if you're not watching the really good things he's doing in this process, then it won't, you won't be able to come back toward him very easily. So, and you do control your attitude. You do get to control what you look at. Now, again, I'm not saying you deny the other, but if he's literally working a program, your natural tendency is going to be to feel what really hurts and irritates, but you're going to have to be really intentional to see what you appreciate. And over time, if you let go of your resentments, there's a good chance you'll be able to come back and find those feelings for him once again. I got time for one more quick one here. There's a gentleman on the forum. His name is, I can't even say it. I want to make it work. I like that. And I may even be on the call today. Basically, he's in an affair. He knows it's wrong, wants out. He's terrified and knows he needs to come clean. However, he's not sure how and is not sure the plan to take. I recommended seeing you, even strategizing with you and I on how to make that work if need be. What advice would you give him for a plan on how to come clean? I'm not sure where he's located, but I know he seems to really want help on a plan of action. I wouldn't have known either, but at the end of the day, God had a plan, and I know he does for this brother also. But in order to circumvent the way the Lord will finally and ultimately probably to expose this, do you have any suggestions on how he can do it? Well, it's funny. I had somebody in my office just this past week, and we were doing this exact same thing. And I don't know that there's a graceful way to do it. I think that maybe sharing with somebody who can be a good support for her afterwards, someone that she could potentially talk to where she's not going to – you have to be careful with that one, because you want to make sure it's not somebody she's going to be mad that you – let them know about this thing. Maybe setting up, if you feel like she's going to have a lot of trouble with it, potentially telling her with a therapist can be very helpful. That's how we did the one last week. That's why I was involved. Those are really difficult circumstances. And when you start telling them, you try to find a place where it's safe to tell them. In other words, you also want to give them the ability to respond. You don't want to take them out to Starbucks or something like that and tell them in public where you feel like you control how they're responding because they don't want to embarrass themselves in public. That's not a good idea. So hopefully, give me a call. I want to make it work. And because getting out of that affair, you know, it may actually take just being able to be honest about it and know it's going to be very difficult. Also, if you haven't done it yet, I would recommend reading the 31 Reasons to Stop an Affair, because it'll at least give you your own motivations for staying out of it. And it's 1 o'clock. Thank you all very much. I'm glad to hear that, Margie. That's me. I hope we've got one question left. We'll just try to put that off onto next week. And I'll be talking to you guys look at that, next Monday. I'll try not to read September's questions. So the healing, I'll talk to y'all later. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.